Chapter 5, New Horizons in Europe. As Machen was about to sail for Europe the third time, he was aware that much more was at stake than in his previous journeys. He could indeed look forward to delightful opportunities of travel and to gaining more solid pleasures from seizing them than before because of his past experience. There would, moreover, be substantial benefits accruing from his participation in the academic life of German universities, of which he had enjoyed an appetizing morsel the preceding year. But now he had completed a course of study designed to prepare men for the ministry. He was about to enter his 25th year, and it was devoutly hoped, both by his loved ones who would remain behind, and by esteemed men to whom he was greatly indebted, that the year abroad would serve to remove every obstacle which might prevent his early entrance upon a fruitful ministry of teaching the New Testament. He himself anticipated great profit from his studies, with the advantages of a fresh atmosphere, time to read and incentive to do so, and no exams. Without question, he prayed fervently that he might once for all pass through the mists that had enveloped him into a sea that would be aglow with light as far as the eye could see. He could not know that there lay ahead storms more tempestuous than any he had ever experienced, and that he would not reach firm ground until many years later, and yet that he would be emboldened to undertake his life's work at the end of the year. Within a few days of his departure from Baltimore, he received fresh assurance of the profound sympathy and support of those whose affection was his most constant source of comfort and strength. His mother's farewell letter was a brief note of affectionate parting, which concluded as follows: "This is only to bid you Godspeed. My prayers and loving thoughts go with you every step of your way. Do not forget to love your mother and to remember that there is one heart on this side of the Atlantic that can never fail you or misunderstand you. God be with you, my dear boy, and goodbye from your own faithful mother, M.G.M." His father's letter, written on the same day, though also replete with tender regard, reflected at some length upon his hopes regarding his son. "My thoughts will follow you on your voyage and afterwards. Earnest prayers for your welfare, sure progress, and happiness will go up night and morning during your absence, and I have faith to believe will be fulfilled. I depend upon you, as upon Arthur and Tom, to perform that good work in the world which will make it worthwhile for me to have lived in my own generation. I have labored in a way, but as I look back at the top of 70 years and more, I am saddened by the reflection that I have accomplished so little for mankind, have fallen so short of the service I owe as a follower of Christ. A father may hope that his sons will more than fill his place, and God has so blessed me in this respect, as in many others, that I have just ground to believe that, notwithstanding my personal shortcomings, I will not have lived in vain when I leave my children here. I shall be glad to hear from you constantly, and kept informed of everything which interests you. It will all greatly interest me. I feel confident you are in the right path, and will come back strengthened and prepared to perform a notable work in the world." Machen's own letter of farewell, written July 13, 1905, and dispatched by pilot from Cape Charles, whence he sailed on the steamer Castle, was addressed to his mother, and was to bring tears to her eyes as she read his loving words. "Here I am at last, with my back turned to dear old Baltimore. When I return, the old town will be unrecognizable. No more burnt district, everything up to date. But my own little corner at 217 will be just the same. I certainly hope so, for in essentials it could not be improved. Where else could be found a father and mother capable of writing two such letters as those which bade me farewell? Nothing else could have so lightened my heart as the assurance that you are all fairly well and cheered with the prospect of a happy summer at Seal Harbor. Despite it all, I can hardly keep from feeling unreasoningly selfish in leaving you all behind again. Of course, I know with what goodwill and love you and Father have been willing to send me off to partake of so much more than my share of the joys of life. Still, three trips to Europe does seem like dissipation for a fellow of 24, when so many must spend a lifetime in hopeless longing. The only cure would be for me to learn something, and I am going to try. But probably the result will by no means come up with what could reasonably be expected. P.S. Don't talk about forgetting to love, Mother. I am just as likely to forget to breathe. Summer Travels. Although our interest in this year abroad lies chiefly in Machen's experiences as a student at Marburg and Göttingen, there were other happenings falling especially in the long interval between his arrival at Bremen on July 24th and his enrollment at Marburg early in October, which add substantially to our knowledge of the more general aspects of his life. The temptation to quote at length from his descriptions of earlier travels has been largely resisted in the foregoing chapters, but some of his letters from the present period are so fascinating that fairly liberal quotation seems mandatory if their contribution to one's understanding of his life is to come to its rights. Passing over his descriptions of Hamburg and Lübeck, we speed southward with him as he rode his bicycle first to Soltau, on the second day to Brunswick, where he had spent a week the previous year, and on to Goslar at the foot of the Harz Mountains. Thus the little city adds beauty of situation to its other charms, the view of Steinberg, a neighboring height, being entrancing. I enjoyed that view at sunset on Friday night, and felt more than repaid for the hot walk. You overlook the old town with its towers, spires, and queer-shaped roofs, and have as a background the dark, soft-colored pine woods of the mountains. The Lion of Goslar itself is the Kaiser House, a large palace dating from a very ancient time, but now restored, so that its age is no longer very apparent. On the whole, I found other things in Goslar more interesting, especially the peculiarly quaint and ancient appearance of the town. Such a richness in old private houses is scarcely offered even by Hildesheim or Brunswick, though Hildesheim can certainly point to more striking single specimens. Leaving Goslar, in a single day he rode some 70 miles over the Harz to Mühlhausen to find himself on August 6th again in the haunts of the previous year. The pretty hills and dales of Thuringen. This country between the Harz and Thuringerwald surpasses for quaint loveliness almost anything I have ever seen. Somehow the church spires seem to take on more picturesque forms than elsewhere, the village to nestle more cozily in the valleys and on the hillsides, the valleys to be more beautifully rounded, the colors of the richly cultivated fields to be more harmoniously blended. It is a country from which angles seem to have been eliminated until nature and art unite in one universal curve. Next followed the delights of Nuremberg and Rothenburg in Bavaria, though mention should be made of his exhilaration with the ride over the Thuringerwald and his pleasure in taking in the old fortress at Coburg because of its having lodged Luther at the time of the formation of the Augsburg Confession in 1530. In arriving at Nuremberg, he had completed a bicycle trip of some 375 miles from Hamburg. Writing from Rothenburg on August 13th, he announces, "We have met Nuremberg, and it is ours. And it is certainly worth capturing. On the whole, I am afraid my cities of northern Germany, Hildesheim, Brunswick, and Goslar, must give the palm to a place which everybody goes to see. Hildesheim has, perhaps, more picturesque houses, but she lacks the ancient walls, which, with their towers and battlements, lend to Nuremberg so much of her charm. But one thing I can affirm, those northern German cities are no mere reprints of Nuremberg. The characteristic old house in Hildesheim and Brunswick and Goslar is the house with the wooden beams and wood carving, with the upper stories projecting far beyond the lower end. And this incomparably picturesque type is only scantily represented in Nuremberg. On the other hand, the way the tall, irregularly placed buildings in Nuremberg pile themselves up until they are surmounted by the wall towers and by the castle is also peculiar. On the whole, I think the most repaying thing that one can do in Nuremberg is to walk all around the walls on the outside and over the various bridges. But within 50 miles of Nuremberg, there is something yet more curious, which the public only within the last few years has discovered to be one of the most remarkable things in the world. I refer to Rothenburg, a town of former importance, which the march of modern progress has left behind, with a population of 8,000, living in the same old houses, on top of the same old hill, and within the same old walls. Is it my duty to attempt a description of Rothenburg? I hope not. There is nothing left for you but to come see Rothenburg for yourself. The little river Tauber, in its course northwestwards to the main, has hereabouts cut for itself a deep channel, which to you and mother might perhaps be described as a mild form of canyon, but with green though steep sides. On one side of the stream, along the high crest of the hills thus formed, stretches the little town, entirely enclosed in its walls. The walls of Rothenburg differ from the walls of, for example, Nuremberg, in that they still form really the limit of the city. In Nuremberg, you have a set of walls stretching aimlessly about somewhere in the center of a good-sized modern city and enclosing a portion of the modern town, something like the city in London. But in Rothenburg, it is different. On the side next to the stream, you find no houses at all outside the wall until you get to the bottom of the valley. On the other side, the town has burst its ancient bounds only in a few places. Rothenburg is still crowded together within its walls and is therefore a walled town in a far more visible way than anything I have seen before. Of course, the details are not so fine as they are in Nuremberg. There are by no means so many or so beautiful examples of ancient city residences and business houses. Everything is on a much more modest scale. But what Rothenburg lacks in magnificence of the individual buildings, it makes up in the harmony of the whole. After all, people have a right to live and to attain wealth and comfort. So we cannot blame the people of Nuremberg because here and there they have sacrificed sentiment and historical interest to the demands of modern life. It is only remarkable how little this sacrifice has been made in the case of a town of such remarkable commercial importance. Rothenburg has no commercial importance, hence its uniqueness. Hence there are no trolley cars on the streets, hence the narrow and crooked lanes still prove adequate to the traffic. Hence there are no large modern buildings put to shame the little old red-roofed houses, which huddle together as if for common protection, as if afraid to stand alone. The whole thing is cut out of one piece. There is practically nothing in the appearance of the place to jolt us about from one century to another. We can still live undisturbed for a little while in the time of the great Burgomaster Toppler of 1400. If we live there too long, we should be only too glad to get back to 1905, for poor old Toppler had a hard enough time of it himself and met his end finally in the dungeon under the Ratos. It must not be thought, however, that the town is entirely composed of mean or ordinary houses. On the contrary, the houses in the neighborhood of the marketplace are, some of them, quite large and handsome, and the Rathaus really attains to magnificence. The main church is also lofty and imposing and forms the center of any view of the town. Inside are to be found some fine works of art, stained glass, and wood carving. Well, yesterday and today I walked in the evening across the river and up to the top of the hills on the opposite side. The view from there is not to be described and hardly to be believed as existing A.D. 1905. Nor is it quaint and curious merely. It is also of the most entrancing beauty. Before you are the broad fields sloping down until they fall off suddenly into the abyss of the Tauber Valley. Beyond, the Middle Ages, the walls visible on both sides of the town, the towers, the gables, the red roofs piled up on the other until they culminate in the great commanding form of the church, and the whole bathed in the light of the sinking sun and set off against the broad rolling fields and the distant wooded ridges. It is all too wonderful to be true. It reminds me of the fine illustrations of Howard Pyle, but for me to be seeing the reality, that seems impossible. A little walking on top of the hills discloses the greatest variety of loveliness, different aspects of the town and different glimpses down into the valley. The latter, with its perfect picture of peace, the quiet little stream, the picturesque farmhouses, the distant village steeple, forms a delightful contrast to towers and battlements above. Well, it's a lovely spot. That is about all I can hope you will get out of these vain words and phrases. In the Eastern Alps. After several days in these fascinating cities, he proceeded in a southwesterly direction by way of Nördlingen to Ulm on the Danube and its great church, and then on along the foot of the Alps as far as Innsbruck, Austria, having now completely traversed Germany from north to south, about 630 miles by bicycle. Innsbruck became the starting point for several days of delightful mountain climbing, in which, accompanied by an expert guide, he made the ascent of the Wilderturm, Wildes Hinterbergel, Ferner Kugel, and other peaks. September had come on when he left Innsbruck and proceeded on his wheel directly south over the Brenner Pass, taking only a little more than a day to make the more than 100 miles to Linz in the Tyrol. Having bought and packed a rucksack at the Linz, he proceeded, first on his wheel and later on foot, to the village of Kals, which lay at the foot of the Grossglockner. At Kals, he relates, I procured as guide a man by the name of Johann Kerrer, who it seems is quite famous. He has been twice to the Caucasus and once to the Himalayas, and knows the Alps from end to end, having just this summer been in Zermatt and in the Oberland. Altogether, I was very lucky not only to get hold of a first-class guide, but also because of what was to be learned from conversing with a man whose activities as mountain guide have carried him into so many different countries. On Wednesday afternoon, we ascended from Kals to the Stutthütte, a hut on the Grossglockner at a height of about 9,330 feet, the most lofty place I ever spent a night. On the way, we passed through the Rudnitz Valley, a picture of which I am sending you today on a postal card. In the course of the afternoon, the clouds kept gathering more and more, and during the night it rained brickbats, which caused my heart to sink into my boots. After two glorious days in the valleys, was bad weather to set in the minute I got up on the heights? In the morning, the question was very soon settled in the negative, for when we started out, about 4 o'clock, with the lantern, the stars were shining with that peculiar brilliancy which you remember from the clear nights at the Madison Hut. The ordinary way up the Grossglockner leads past the Erzherzog Johann Hut, which the enterprise of the Austrian Alpine Club maintains as a little hotel at the height of 11,500 feet. From there you go over steep snow and rocks to the top of the Kleinglockner, and from there over a narrow ridge to the summit of the Grossglockner, about 12,600 feet, the highest peak of the group, and one of the highest of the Eastern Alps. The ascent was made perfectly easy by wire ropes, which are stretched in all places, which otherwise might, to the unpracticed, be a little bit ticklish, notably on the ridge between the lower and higher peak. We reached the top at about 7 a.m., and I spent a half hour or so in enjoying the wonderful view which stretches as far as the Great Ortler Group to the southwest. When the air is more perfectly clear, you can see the Adriatic Sea. Nor is it the great extent alone which makes the view from the Glockner so particularly grand, for few things could be finer than the view over the almost boundless snowfields and glaciers to the pointed Weissbachhorn at the other end of the group. Such things cannot be described, and I shall not attempt the impossible. Returning to the upper hut, I partook of some solid food, and instead of returning directly to Kull's, decided to take a 2.5 days trip planned by the guide. For this plan, I am profoundly grateful to him, for I do not see how, in any other way, I could have obtained such a variety of beauty and grandeur. The same scene was never thrown on the screen a second time, but instead a continual succession. 1 minute, the vast circle of snow and rock to be seen from the summit. The next minute, the no less overpowering grandeur of the middle altitudes. Perhaps from the strictly aesthetic point of view, the latter scenes are the finer, for from the middle heights, perhaps more than anywhere else, do you fully appreciate the enormous bulk of the mountains. And then from the peaks, there is so much to be seen that the individuality of each view can hardly impress itself on the mind. The picture lacks the artistic unity of, for example, that view of the Glockner from the Rudnitz Valley. But I am not an artist, and to me the sense of boundless height and freedom, which one can obtain only on such mountains as the Glockner or Monte Rosa, can never be replaced by anything else. However, one kind of view rivals the view from the top, namely, the view of a fine mountain which you have already ascended. At any rate, whatever kind of mountain view is the finest, you can be sure that it is represented on our 3 days' route. The trip amounted, in brief, to ascending the Glockner and then going entirely around it. I thus was enabled to enjoy the principal beauties of the 4 chief valleys that cut into the Glockner group, the valleys of Kulls and Heiligenblut on the south, and Verleiten and Moserboden on the north, those beauties and 10,000 others. The letter continues for 7 more closely written pages in equally gripping fashion, telling of the thrills of the ascent of the Weissbachhorn, 11,900 feet, and his return to Linz to spend Sunday. Summing up the benefits of his mountain climbing, he declared that physically he felt in much better shape than at the beginning of the summer. His German had not suffered because he had not seen a single English or American tourist on the mountain trips. His admiration of the clean quarters and excellent provisions of the huts maintained by the German and Austrian clubs knew no bounds, but he felt that these clubs suffered in comparison with the Swiss because of their tendency to introduce an artificial element by putting up wire ropes and building paths. Nor was Machen quite content to call it a day as far as the first-hand contacts with the Eastern Alps were concerned, for with the Dolomites so near at hand, he could not resist coming to grips with a few samples of that strange and bizarre region which impressed him as savage and yet possessed of a beauty of a peculiarly fascinating kind. And after climbing the Grosse and the Kleine Zinne, the time was running out, and he wanted to see Vienna, Budapest, and Salzburg before returning to Germany and settling at one of the universities for the winter term. Vienna offered many attractive features. The general beauty of the city itself, with its magnificent modern buildings in the midst of gardens, the museums, and the theaters. Budapest was found to be more grandly situated along the banks of the Danube, but its life and language more exotic than Vienna's, and his stay there was rather brief, though long enough to arouse his sympathy with the liberty-seeking Hungarians. After a brief, thoroughly satisfying visit to Salzburg and vicinity, he returned to Munich, now again on his wheel, after some discouraging experiences with the crowded and crawling trains of that area. October had now come, and it was time to hurry on to Marburg. He looked back on the fascinating experiences of the summer with delight and gratitude, but duty was now calling him to devote his energies largely to academic labors. At Marburg University. The decision to spend the winter term at Marburg had been reached in Vienna on the basis of published announcements of the courses to be offered in the several universities and of the professors who would be lecturing at that time. The announcement concerning Marburg indicated that Adolf Jülicher, the principal attraction, was to offer several courses, and besides, Johannes Weiss and two younger men were to conduct work in the New Testament, thus assuring him of ample and varied instruction in his field. Jülicher, who had gained fame as a brilliant scholar and teacher, was widely known for his Introduction to the New Testament and the Parables of Jesus. Although Weiss had, at 42, written a number of important books, he had not yet come into the prominence that he was to achieve in the 9 years that remained before his untimely death in 1914. Marburg is situated on the Lahn River in Hesse-Nassau, a province of Prussia. It is an old town, and the university, its principal claim to distinction, was founded in 1527. At the turn of the century, its population was about 20,000, about half the size of Göttingen, but Machen found it primitive and village-like. It had its charm, however, as its designation, the Pearl of Hesse, discloses, and from the first, the town and its surroundings captured Machen's admiration. "All around," he wrote, "are high wooded hills, upon one of which towers the ancient palace. And the old part of the town is built actually upon the slope, and from a distance as well as from near at hand presents a highly picturesque appearance with its irregular houses. The most beautiful thing in Marburg is the Elisabethkirche, not a very large church, but of a kind to impress you more and more. The style is Gothic, but exceedingly massive and simple, and entirely unlike the Gothic, for example, of the French churches I have seen. Thus, the Elisabethkirche seems like anything but a reduced copy of the great cathedrals." Acting on the friendly advice offered by Professor Weiss, he was able rather soon to fulfill his desire of coming into intimate contact with German-speaking families in town, and arranged to take his meals with Frau Professor Link, the widow of a theological professor, and to lodge with Frau Kummel. Both he found to be jolly, sociable people, and he became much attached to them and the members of their household, though for a time a great strain was put upon him by the fact that the young children of a missionary's family who had rooms above his frequently were so noisy that he was distracted from his efforts to study. During the first months in Marburg, Machen felt rather lonely and perhaps even homesick, for at first he found it difficult to cultivate friendships among the students. However cordial Frau Professor Link and Frau Kummel might be, they could not satisfy his craving for the kind of fellowship that had warmed his heart at Princeton and that he had left behind so reluctantly. Even his first letter, written before the lectures got under way, was so blue that his mother wrote of her sympathy and pain at receiving it. Reflecting on this, he wrote his father that, "Mother must not take my fits of blue too seriously. Either that or I must try to keep my letters from reflecting so clearly the feelings of the moment," and proceeded to dwell on the brighter side of things. But his mother countered with the plea, "You must never veil your mood in writing to us for fear of distressing me. I should never know a comfortable moment if I thought you would hide anything disagreeable, for I should always be trying to read between the lines. So pour out every phase of your life, knowing that I shall be eager to hear all." How he missed also the exhilaration of the football games that had given him so much pleasure at Princeton. In urgently requesting that scores be relayed to him, he indicates that they at least might make slight compensation for the lost opportunity of witnessing the games. "When I see a vacant field on one of these autumn days, my mind is filled with wonder at this benighted people, which does not seem to hear the voice of nature when she commands every human being to play football or watch it being played. I have a positive longing to see a football game, and not being able to see one, the next best thing is scores." Letters from home. Some scores were sent in response to this moving entreaty, but unquestionably the greatest cheer came in the frequent letters that he received from the members of his family. The October number of the Princeton Theological Review, with the first installment of his article on the virgin birth of Christ, had appeared, and congratulations were the order of the day. Most amusing of these was the evaluation of Professor H. E. Green, professor of collegiate English at Johns Hopkins, as reported by his brother Arthur. "The other day I saw Herbert Eveleth Green at the University Club. Fortunately, Tom had warned me that he had shaved off his whiskers, for otherwise I never should have known him. He at once broached the subject of your article, which he had read with great interest. 'There,' said he, 'is a scholar, and I know, for I have made a special study of the same topic. It is a fine work, fine work. If he keeps that up, in 10 years he'll be heard from. But,' said he, continuing with a grieved expression, 'e'en the great orb of day is flecked with wandering isles of night.' Here his eyes watered, and I thought he was going to weep and make a scene in the clubhouse. But he recovered himself and proceeded. 'Alas, he has used the expression, a kind of a—' Horror struck at the thought, I could scarcely speak. He continued, 'as he has written, proven a Scotticism. A pity 'tis that these, the only two faults in the article, should give occasion to the unbeliever to scoff. When you get the opportunity, remind him of my instruction upon these two points. I said I would mention them in my next letter home.' 'On no account should you do so,' he replied, 'for that would be giving my criticisms too much prominence. But,' he continued dreamily, 'without these blemishes, the article would be as faultless as one of Andrea del Sarto's paintings. I have disobeyed his injunction and give you a report of the conversation. In all seriousness, however, I am deriving real profit from what you have written. The style is clear and the reasoning sound, and the whole argument is as safe and sane as Parker's Democracy. Machen's father wrote exceptionally long letters relating to his business and pleasure, which are reported at some length because of their unusual testimony to his life as a lawyer and book lover. As well, they display his talents as a writer, which is the more noteworthy if one keeps in view the fact that he was in his 79th year. Although his father's letters through the years were marked by almost total silence with regard to business affairs, he now responded at some length to his son's request for news of this sort. In a letter begun on November 26, 1905, and concluded the next day, late at night, he introduces an account of legal work in which he had been associated with his eldest son following Baltimore's disastrous fire of February 1904. He and I laterally have been very much occupied with the Patterson Dock cases, which we have been compelled to make the unequal fight against the city, whose strength is tyrannously used against property owners who do not knuckle under to the dictates of the Burnt District Commission. November 27. It now wants less than 10 minutes of midnight, and I have been hard at work all the evening compiling a lot of bills of exceptions, the necessary foundation for an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States from an unsatisfactory decision in one of the Patterson Dock condemnation cases, and there is more of such work to follow. The mayor has thought proper to send me a note suggesting, or rather inviting, a visit to talk over the matter of the controversy between our clients and the city. I have not much hope of anything coming of it. So delusive, not to say treacherous, have been all proper colloquies with city officers, looking ostensibly for a fair adjustment. However, I thought it my duty to accept the tender of the olive branch, and called in response at the mayor's office. But being occupied at the time with other official business, he made an appointment for an interview next Wednesday morning. A later letter told of gratifying success in this litigation. In the Patterson Dock fighting, we have come out on top. In vain did the newspaper scribblers in the service of the Burnt District Commission vituperate and abuse such persons as Machen and Machen, who presumed to stand up for the rights of their clients against the artificially swollen tide of public opinion. Vainly did weak and biased juries give verdicts for less than the worth of the properties condemned. Vainly did judges, unconsciously swayed by the popular current, make rulings on points of law against us. We pursued the even tenor of our way and availed of the right the law gave us to appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. Finally, the city authorities have been convinced of the expediency of settling with us upon the reasonable basis, which was all we ever insisted upon. My judgment was vindicated when the last jury trial was had. It then distinctly appears that we were determined and able to take every case to the United States Supreme Court with the possibility of a decision holding the whole condemnation scheme void as far as we were concerned, and a strong probability of at least getting new jury trials with more beneficial rulings upon questions of evidence. Then we were assailed publicly and privately with the cry, "What, will you, by your appeals, put an obstruction in the way of a great public improvement until the gamut of judicial controversy has been run through?" For my part, I bore all this talk with great serenity. My clients were entitled to fair and adequate compensation, and until they received it, I was not going to abandon any lawful resource. The city authorities, not I, had insisted on the regular course of law, and by the law must abide, unless a reasonable and fair amicable settlement were made. Such a settlement has been agreed upon. I demanded the same sum which, in the way of compromise, I had offered to take in October. i.e. after the rejection of my proposal of arbitration and before the expenses of any jury trials had been incurred, plus those expenses. I named a round sum upon this basis, and this the controlling city authorities, to the disgust of the Burnt District Commission, who were incensed with us for our presumptuous opposition and showed all along a strong disposition to crush us if they could, have accepted. The formal agreement is to be signed in the course of a few days, and before a fortnight is over, the chancery proceedings requisite to convey title will have been completed, the money paid, and the whole affair become an old and nearly forgotten story. I should have thought this a tedious and uselessly wearisome tale for the telling in a letter, but for the interest you have expressed. The father, no doubt, took greater delight in recounting in his letter of December 20, 1905, the pleasures afforded by a memorable dinner. Last evening was signalized by the meeting at our house of the club of book lovers named Dr. Osler, taking up a sort of suggestion of mine, The Ship of Fools. I gave them, with the valuable directing aid of your mother, a very good dinner topped out with some of my old Madeira, which all seemed to enjoy. A family council composed of your mother, Arthur, and myself, held a day or two before the day, determined that something in the way of originality in the dinner cards must be devised. I invited help from the other two, but none seemed to be forthcoming. The time, 3 days only, afforded little space for cogitation or research, and I was compelled, like the driver of the classic stalled ox wagon, to put my own shoulder to the wheel as vigorously as I might. Mr. Buckler, at the first dinner of his, had felicitously made it a Charles Lamb affair, a roast pig for Pace de Resistance, and apt sentences from Elia adapted severally to the guests and written upon pieces of antique paper. I felt so imperfectly acquainted with the peculiarities and idiosyncrasies of most of my fellow members that I despaired of finding appropriate individual mottos suitable for the occasion. Happily, in this strait, it occurred to me to look for a motto fitting the club collectively as passengers in the Ship of Fools. This plan had the advantage of putting us all together in the category of fools, whereas it would have been a rather delicate matter for me, the host of the evening, to assume to fit a special cap to the head of each guest. I bethought me of the great storehouse of quaint conceits, Burton's Anatomy. In a few moments I lighted in the first book upon a passage, a copy of which I enclose, which seems to me to describe aptly enough our assembly, typified in the curious cuts in the Brant Locker edition of the Multifera Nuvis, printed by J. Bergman de Olpa in 1497, my copy of which you have seen. I had thus handsomely engrossed, though not in the more antique style I should have aimed to have effected if there had been more time, upon pieces of parchment with names of the 11 diners inscribed respectively at the bottom. As soon as we could dispatch the dinner, which included in the courses terrapins, capon, and canvas-back ducks, and could not be slighted too much, we adjourned to the library upstairs, where, with the accompaniment of cigars, etc., the inspection of the choicer books, incunabula, Aldine's, Elzevir's, Stevens's, Baskerville's, etc., proceeded. Altogether, we had a very fine time. At any rate, Arthur and I thought so. Kirby Smith had invited us all to meet at his house on the day in January, which, upon consultation with our Washington friends, seemed to be practically available. I believe it is the 17th. And as it is announced that Dr. Osler is on the ocean now, in expectation of spending 3 or 4 weeks in Baltimore, it is expected to receive him also. This is a long rigmarole story, isn't it? But you see, In order to be consistently one with the crew of the Stultifera, I am bound to afford a specimen of my folly. Student life. The reception of such letters, and of many others which, though perhaps not as amusing or informative as the above, were replete with affection, went a long way in cheering him up those first months in Marburg. After about 2 months, however, an entirely new face was put on his life as a student when the barrier of the reserve of the students was broken through and he became associated with one of the student clubs, the Franconia Verbindung. Although not invited to become a full-fledged member, he was given the status of Hospitant, or guest, and as such not only saw German student life at close range, but made several acquaintances. This new happy change in his life in Marburg was reported at some length in a letter of December 12, 1905. It has recently occurred to me that if I am to write a letter which shall stand even the slightest chance of arriving in time to be really a Christmas message, I must be at it at once. Although the 25th is still some time off, yet my thoughts have long ago begun to turn specially toward home, when I reflect that the family is soon to celebrate the first Christmas at which I am not one of the circle. Although I am not to be present in person, yet I hope this poor little line will at least accomplish the purpose of letting you know that my thoughts are up in the library, enjoying the presence and the love which gives them their real meaning, and which I am as sure of this year as though I were at home. The assurance of the continued affection of you all deprives the foreign Christmas of any dolefulness or loneliness which it might otherwise well possess. I hope that you feel as sure of my love as I do of yours. If you do not, this letter has not accomplished its purpose. There has been a big change for the better in my circumstances at Marburg, for I have been accepted for the rest of the year as Hospitant by the Verbindung Franconia. I find I made a mistake in supposing I was Konknipant, which involves the right to wear the colors and is a closer bond than that of a mere guest. However, I could not be better satisfied, for my present relation to the society gives me a good deal more freedom than I should possess if it were possible for me to become a regular member. It would be very pleasant to be formally initiated and to be addressed as "do," but by no means so pleasant to comply with the complicated rules and regulations. For example, when wearing the colors, a member is not allowed to enter any stores except certain highly respectable bookstores, etc. He is not allowed to carry a package. He must attend all meetings, which are frequent, etc., etc. It is necessary to give a regular course of instruction to the freshmen. As it is, I have been received with most extraordinary hospitality and kindness, and find it awfully pleasant to have somebody to chat with between classes, as well as at the NEPA. On Monday and Tuesday evenings, from about 10 o'clock on ad infinitum, those of the fellows who happen to have time sit together in a certain restaurant. Yesterday I went and found it delightfully informal. You come when you please and go when you please, but you are sure of company at any hour. Franconia is, as you may judge, a Verbindung with rather different principles from those of the regular duel-fighting societies. Drinking is not compulsory, though, to say the least, usual. A comparative moderation is observed, etc., but the whole thing is nevertheless characteristically German. Though Machen found some features of student life rather odd, such as the exaggerated forms of politeness observed between the men, he entered rather fully into it, and was happy at being in the swim. If you are not in with the crowd, he wrote his father, you see very little of one side of German university life, if for no other reason, because you are usually in bed before things get really started. From 12 o'clock at night on, the streets are alive with students and only students, so that Marburg appears in its true character as a real university town. On one occasion, he even joined in a Nachtbummel, an all-night excursion on foot to a village about 20 miles away. One result was that that 8 o'clock class, where recently I have a number of times been the only student present, had somehow to get along without me. But I managed to get in for Hermann at 11. Christmas Eve fell on a Sunday in 1905, and since there seemed to be something incongruous between certain celebrations of Christmas and the proper observance of Sunday, he wondered at first whether he should not simply go away quietly by himself. But upon further reflection, he thought it would be a violation of the spirit of the fourth commandment not to join in a simple little Christmas celebration of the Lynx. Describing the celebration afterward, he wrote that, after the one servant had joined the party, a few Christmas songs were sung, and Frau Link read a passage from Luke, and then we all went into the next room where the lovely Christmas tree was resplendent with lights. The delight at the numerous presents, the German women spend a good part of the year in their Weihnachtsarbeit, was just as great as it is with us, and nobody could help falling in with the spirit of the occasion. Nor was I myself forgotten, for I received a lot of things to eat, and one or two other little presents, which kept me from feeling in the slightest degree out in the cold. The spirit of Christmas, where it is really celebrated in a family, is a good deal the same all over the world, and I was deeply touched at being so cordially received. On the 25th, he left for Berlin and enjoyed the size and grandeur of that great city as a welcome change from primitive Marburg with its sloughs and puddles. Goethe's Götz von Berlichingen, Schiller's Jungfrau von Orleans, and Shakespeare's Othello were among the chief attractions at the Berlin theaters, and he took some lessons in Italian at the Berlitz School. And so, in spite of interludes of depression and heart-searching, there were aspects of life in Germany, and especially at the university, which filled him with satisfaction. The Marburg Professors. One would be quite unfair to Machen if the conclusion were drawn from the foregoing that he did not put in a great deal of hard study at Marburg. He was not one to enlarge upon such matters in his letters home, as his earlier letters from Princeton also show, and if he dwelt at times upon extracurricular activities, that was due to his judgment that these, rather than the humdrum routine of lectures and reading, would prove most interesting to those at home. Nevertheless, the real story told by his letters is that of his intellectual and spiritual reaction to the teaching in the university rather than of such aspects of his life as have come under review. While immensely grateful for the emancipation from rules requiring attendance upon classes, he was evidently very faithful in this regard, as even his allusion to his single absence from the 8 o'clock lecture confirms. Moreover, he undertook a much larger program of reading than his tight Princeton schedule had allowed, concentrating on books dealing with subject matter under discussion in the classroom, including naturally books written by the leading professors. Thus, he took full advantage of the instruction offered, and his estimate of his professors and his response to their teaching are of extraordinary interest. Ulliker fully lived up to the expectations based upon his reputation, and indeed Machen came to admire his work more and more as time went on. On November 2, he wrote that Ulliker even grows on me, though my first impression was very favorable. He is simply bubbling over with enthusiasm, and being gifted with lots of common sense and the power of terse expression, he is able to transmit his enthusiasm to the class. 10 days later, he spoke again of his common sense, which enables him to cut short a lot of worthless over-exegesis with which the New Testament has been obscured for hundreds of years, and with a lively imagination which enables him to make the situation and the consequent emotion of the writer really alive to the class. Ulliker's learning is beyond question, hence that does not need to be mentioned. But these other gifts are not so common. That 9 o'clock hour is certainly great. Machen was aware, of course, of Ulliker's very different estimate of the message of the New Testament from that taught at Princeton. But his basic liberalism did not prevent his lectures on Galatians from being very stimulating. Moreover, the breadth of his learning was exceptional, and his scholarly disposition temperate, in spite of his rejection of the supernatural, so that he could single out for special praise a work like that of Lightfoot's. Johannes Weiss was a man whom Machen was to feel later he had done gross injustice, and this convinced him, like his later boundless admiration of Warfield, that callow students are not likely to be the best judges of the lasting worth of their instruction. He contrasted Weiss unfavorably with Ulliker, even stating that he could not think of him to be at all a scholar of the first rank, and declaring that perhaps his claim to renown lies chiefly in the fact that he is the son of Bernard Weiss of Berlin. Weiss's later exceedingly learned and influential works on 1 Corinthians and primitive Christianity compelled him to admit that his perception had been lamentably superficial. The younger men lecturing in the New Testament field were Rudolf Knopf and Walter Bauer, other men who did not then seem outstanding, but who later were to gain considerable distinction. The former's lectures on New Testament introduction and the latter's on John's Gospel were followed faithfully. Bauer lectured at 8 a.m. on 4 days a week, and due to his youth and the unattractiveness of the hour, the enrollment was limited to 2 Germans, 1 Englishman, and Machen. On November 12th, they reported that the 2 Germans are irregular in their attendance, and on several occasions the lecture has begun for the benefit of my unworthy self alone. Later, as noted, when he joined more fully in the student life at the university, even Machen failed to show up one morning. Since Bauer was later to publish a radical commentary on John, it is of interest that Machen noted that he then had a poor opinion of its historical worth and had not yet shown much real understanding of its religious greatness. Captivation by Hermann. Though Machen was principally occupied with New Testament studies, he was apparently affected, for the time at least, far more deeply by his contact with another department. In fact, it is hardly an overstatement to say that Wilhelm Hermann, professor of theology, was responsible for one of the most overwhelming intellectual and religious experiences of his life, an experience which, though not the instrument of initiating indecision and doubt, seems to have been chiefly responsible for prolonging and intensifying his religious struggle, and thereby causing him to be even more skeptical than before as to the possibility of entering the ministry. Hermann's teaching accomplished what the other instruction apparently could not do alone, but in the accomplishment of it affected more or less strongly the impact made by the other exponents of liberal views. In short, Hermann made liberalism wonderfully attractive and heart-gripping. This he did not so much by the plausibility of intellectual argument as by the magnetic and overpowering force of his fervent religious spirit. Hermann's position and influence as an eloquent spokesman for the Richelian or liberal theology has often been expounded and appraised, and it would take us beyond the scope of this volume to enter upon even a summary statement of its tenets. His theological and religious views have received succinct and vivid expression in his Communion of the Christian with God and his Systematic Theology. Many years later, Machen was to have basically this point of view in mind when he drew a sharp line between liberalism and Christianity. For the present, however, when we are seeking to illumine, especially his personal history, it seems best to dwell upon his thoughts and feelings of those days as he expressed them without reserve or calculation to loved ones at home who could be counted upon for the utmost sympathy and understanding. The first reference to Hermann occurs in a letter to his mother on October 24, when he said, "The most important thing that has happened in my 3 days since Sunday was my first lecture with Professor Hermann. If my first impression is any guide, I should say that the first time that I heard Hermann may almost be described as an epoch in my life. Such an overpowering personality I think I almost never before encountered. Overpowering in the sincerity of religious devotion. Hermann may be illogical and one-sided, but I tell you he is alive." When Browning wrote his description of the German lecture room, he had never listened to Professor Hermann of Marburg. I am now engaged in a perusal of Hermann's book, Die Werke des Christen mit Gott, and postpone further estimates of the author until I have gotten a little deeper insight into what he is trying to say. Unfortunately, the course of lectures is a continuation of the one of last summer, but he is helping out the new student by giving a brief resume of what has gone before. 4 days later, in writing to his father, he said that Hermann must be put in a different category from all the other professors. "I can't criticize him, as my chief feeling with reference to him is already one of the deepest reverence. Since I have been listening to him, my other studies have for a time lost interest to me, for Hermann refuses to allow the student to look at religion from a distance as a thing to be studied merely. He speaks right to the heart, and I have been thrown all into confusion by what he says. So much deeper is his devotion to Christ than anything I have known in myself during the past few years. I don't know at all what to say as yet, for Hermann's views are so revolutionary. But certain I am that he has found Christ, and I believe that he can show how others may find him, though perhaps afterwards, in details, he may not be a safe guide. In fact, I am rather sorry I have said even so much in a letter, for I don't know at all yet what to think." Although he confesses his lack of readiness to analyze Hermann's position with anything like finality, he cannot escape the feeling that he was a genuine follower of Christ when he wrote to his brother Arlie on November 2nd. "Hermann and his religious earnestness and moral power have been a revelation to me. Not only has he given me a new sympathy for the prevailing German religious thought, but also I hope I may leave his classroom better morally and in every way than when I entered it. Hermann affirms very little of that which I have been accustomed to regard as essential to Christianity, yet there is no doubt in my mind but that he is a Christian, and a Christian of a peculiarly earnest type. He is a Christian not because he follows Christ as a moral teacher, but because his trust in Christ is, practically, if anything, even more truly than theoretically, unbounded. It is inspiring to see a man so completely centered in Christ, even though some people might wonder how he reaches this result and still holds the views that he does about the accounts of Christ in the New Testament." 10 days later, he expresses himself somewhat more soberly to his father. "Of course, it is not all quite like those glorious first two or three lectures, for details are never quite as inspiring as general principles. Yet Hermann is never stupid or anything like it. He is a wonderful man." But on the 10th, he is prepared to express a somewhat more mature judgment, and it is still enthusiastic. Hermann is professor of dogmatics and represents the dominant Rischlian school, of whose principles I have very hazy notions. At any rate, Hermann has shown me something of the religious power which lies back of this great movement, which is now making a fight even for the control of the Northern Presbyterian Church in America. In New England, those who do not believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus are, generally speaking, religiously dead. In Germany, Hermann has taught me that that is by no means the case. He believes that Jesus is the one thing in all the world that inspires absolute confidence and an absolute joyful subjection. That through Jesus we come into communion with the living God and are made free from the world. It is the faith that is a real experience, a real revelation that God saves us, not the faith that consists in accepting as true a lot of dogmas on the basis merely of what others have said. Every Christian is conscious of having experienced a miracle, but it is a miracle in his own inner life. We are absolutely dependent upon the grace of God who saves us without our cooperation. There is no use in my trying to give a resume of Hermann. I repent already of what I have written, for it can only make you wonder what I find so inspiring about him. But you would no longer wonder if you could hear him speak and could read what he has written. In my opinion, Der Verkehr des Christen mit Gott is one of the greatest religious books I ever read. Perhaps Hermann does not give the whole truth. I certainly hope he does not. At any rate, he has gotten hold of something that has been sadly neglected in the church and in the Orthodox theology. Perhaps he is something like the devout mystics of the Middle Ages. They were one-sided enough, but they raised a mighty protest against the coldness and deadness of the church and were forerunners of the Reformation. Later, Machen was to see that the Christ to whom Hermann was fervently devoted never really existed, and that religious experience is not as such self-validating. Evidently, to a significant extent, he became aware even while he heard and read Hermann of basic weaknesses and inadequacies. He certainly never came to the point of substituting Hermann's views for those of Orthodox Christianity. Nevertheless, he was profoundly unsettled and even overwhelmed by his encounter with this man whose fervor and moral earnestness put many Christians to shame. And even when he came to reject his theology without qualification, he remained affected by the experience, at least to the extent of being concerned to deal in dead earnest with the views of his opponents and of being tenderly sympathetic with those who might be passing through similar struggles of doubt. Two revealing letters. Two remarkable letters of Professor Armstrong's from this period reflect the considerable change of outlook that had taken place within a month of his coming to Marburg. The first was an answer to a letter from Vienna, which contained the startling message that Machen was determined not to accept the fellowship award. It read as follows. Princeton, October 11, 05. Dear Doss, your letter from Vienna, dated September 26, reached me on October 9th. The same day, Mr. Anderson forwarded me the letter you had written him, saying that he had written you that the matter has been referred to me. I have been pondering just what to write you. First of all, let me say that I deeply appreciate your kind words with reference to myself. Whatever I have been able to do for you, if it has been a help rather than a hindrance, will always be a source of pleasure and gratification to me. I only wish I could impress upon you the warmth of my regard for you and the high esteem in which I hold your work. I have frequently felt that you did not do yourself justice in your own thought of yourself. The whole faculty is quite at one with me in this judgment, having and expressing a confidence in you and your work, which in my experience with them is unusual. In regard to the fellowship money, I do not know just what the circumstances are to which you refer as having led you to the decision expressed in your letter. I cannot therefore reason with you about your decision. I feel, however, that I ought to state the facts relative to the fellowship as I understand them, and leave it open to you to reconsider the whole matter and withdraw or reaffirm your decision. The fellowship is essentially in the nature of a prize. You won it in open competition, having fulfilled all the requirements connected with its bestowal. The appointment was made by the faculty and the directors. The conditions of acceptance are quite simply involving no other obligation than study in New Testament work for 1 year under the direction of our faculty. Further than this, you are in no way obligated. When you have completed a year's work, you will have discharged every obligation involved in accepting the fellowship. This you apparently expect to do. I fear you have been allowing yourself to think that the receipt of the money would in some way obligate you in the future after the year of study is finished. I do not think that this is the case. So think the matter over again before reaching your final decision. Should you then abide by your decision not to receive the money, I am quite sure that the faculty would be willing to have you remain in the position of the New Testament fellow. And you know that in any event, not only for the year you spend in Germany, but so long as you may wish it, any service that I can render you will be most gladly performed. I think your decision to go to Marburg a good one. You will find Ulliker very stimulating. Hermann also, you might hear occasionally in dogmatics, if for no other reason than to come into contact with his vigorous, earnest, and devout spirit. J. Weiss will tell you about as many exciting things as anyone. Then you might be interested in A. Thumb's work in Hellenistic Greek. It will be a pleasure to me to think of you in the surroundings in which I made my first acquaintance with German and Rischlian theology. The first part of your article is now out in the October number of the Review. I think it is in pretty good shape, and with Warfield's gives character to the number. Now, Das, don't let the fellowship matter bother you. Do as you think best, and the decision, whatever it be, will be satisfactory to me, and I am sure to the faculty. They all have full confidence in you. With every good wish and the assurance of my warm regard, sincerely your friend, W. P. Armstrong. The second letter discloses that Machen had remained adamant as far as the fellowship was concerned, but reflects further upon his profoundly disturbed state of mind. Princeton, New Jersey, November 12, 05. Dear Das, your letter of October 29th reached me on the 10th. I have read it over several times, and I must confess that I am somewhat at a loss to tell you just what feeling it has called forth in me. It is easier to tell you of the decision I reached after considering the contents of your letter and of the action that I have taken, although I am confident that you are fully entitled to the fellowship money. I do not consider the reception and use of it a condition of holding the fellowship. It is evidently intended as a means to aid the fellow in accomplishing the work expected of him. It therefore lies within the fellow's right to dispense with the money if he thinks best and still remain the New Testament fellow by fulfilling the appointed work. I did not think, however, that I ought to act in this matter without the approval of the faculty. At the meeting of the faculty yesterday, I stated to those present that you did not wish to receive the income of the fellowship endowment to which you were entitled, but that you were willing to do the work expected of the New Testament fellow should they wish to continue your appointment. The faculty were of the opinion that the money was rightfully yours, but that you need not receive it if you did not desire to do so. They were also quite willing to have you remain the New Testament fellow. They instructed me to inform Mr. Anderson that the fellowship money was to be held subject to your order, that it might be used by you should you change your decision, as Warfield expressed it. There was no need to burn your bridges behind you before you had completed the journey. The idea of the faculty seemed to be that the money should be held for you until you had completed your work as fellow, and then, should you wish, you could write me stating that you did not intend to draw it, but would like to have it added to the endowment of the fellowship. I am very much gratified to know that you are enjoying your work at Marburg. I knew you would like Hermann. When I heard him, he reminded me more of Dr. Purvis than any man in Germany whom I was privileged to hear. And now, Doss, in regard to yourself, what you have written me has only deepened my respect for you and convinced me that my confidence in you has not been misplaced. I know perfectly well that you will do honest work, whatever may have been the trials through which you have passed, and I judge from your letters that they have been severe. I feel perfectly confident that you will come through them safely, chastened perhaps by your experience, but not the less fit for the service of our common Savior. I cannot tell you how my heart goes to you in sympathy, for you have suffered. Your suffering has been in that sphere where each of us stands face to face with God. It is in this sphere that relief will come, even as the desire for relief comes from God Himself. I know your faith will give you the victory, and with victory the joy and peace that comes from the quiet confidence in all God's providence and gracious leading of a child of His for whom Christ died. Don't let pretense, false appearance, deceit of self or others worry you, inasmuch as we know well that there is no deceit of God, who looks in the heart and judges of the motives. In our relation to Him, be right, and it can be made right in Christ. Then we need not trouble ourselves about the world. How thankful we ought to be that there is one person who knows our life even better than we do ourselves, and that knowing it in all its darkness, He has yet made it possible for us to live in the light and blessings of His love. You will think that I have taken upon myself to give the advice of a father confessor without having had such advice asked of me. And I must confess that what I have written is something like advice. If it has assumed this form, however, let the form go and take what I have said simply as an indication and symbol, or what you will, of my intense sympathy and abiding confidence in you and your work. With warm regard, sincerely your friend, W.P. Armstrong. Machen did not change his mind with regard to the fellowship award, and to some extent we can understand why. If already before his encounter with Hermann he determined, in his unsettled state, to relieve his mind of an inescapable feeling that its acceptance involved at least a measure of commitment to carry through a definite program of preparation for the future, how could he, when deeper perplexities and doubts assailed him, abandon that somewhat greater sense of liberty to follow only where conviction might lead?